say, "Snap a picture of Hertha Oberhäuser? You're kidding. I'll provide transit papers and money." Was she really asking me to go see Hertha? I conjured up her face, the smug look, the bored expression. My stomach contracted. Was I going to be sick there on the perfect grass? "I'm sorry. You've been very kind to us, but no thank you." I started along the gravel path toward the house. Caroline followed. "Sometimes we must sacrifice for the greater good." I stopped and turned. "We?" "So Susanna would stay here safe while I alone went to find Hertha? Please just consider it, dear. But take your time. We'll go make a fresh pot of coffee." The pig woke with a start, struggled to her feet, and followed as we walked to the house, our steps crunching in the gravel. It felt good to be needed by Caroline, but she was asking the impossible. To go see Dr. Oberhäuser? Would I have to talk to her? Would she recognize me? Remember Matka? By the time we made it to the house, I realized Caroline was right about the roses. Once the sun was overhead, the fragrance was gone. Chapter 44. Kasha. 1959. Back in Lublin, things had changed so much. I'd been gone less than 9 months, but it felt like 10 years. Pietrik had moved us to our own apartment at the Lubga Ladies' Garment Factory where he worked, just outside of the city. The whole place was no bigger than Caroline's kitchen in Connecticut. But it was ours, just the three of us. No Papa, no Marta. Susanna was with Sergei in Connecticut. 2 bedrooms, all for us. The kitchen was compact, barely big enough to turn around in. On my day off in the hospital, I sewed blue curtains Matka would have loved, gingham, with birds along the hems, and I arranged the 2 little bottles of vodka the stewardess from my flight home had given me along the kitchen windowsill. Pietrik seemed happy to have me home. Had he missed me? He would not say, and I was not about to ask. But he was all smiles when he met me at the airport, a single pink rose in hand. I was all smiles as well with my new tooth. Perhaps things would be better between us. Why did I feel so shy with him, my husband? I could walk so much better, too. The pain pills the Mount Sinai doctor gave me to ease the little discomfort I still had were running out, so I was irritable at times. But I was eager to make things right again, to get back to how it was before the war. One late afternoon that fall, I went to the postal center to see Papa. He handed me a package through the bars of the pickup window.
"I got to this before the censors did," he whispered.
The package was no bigger than a shoebox and wrapped in brown paper.
"Be careful about what your friends mail you."
The return address was C. Faraday, 31 East 50th Street, New York, NY, USA. Caroline had been smart not to send it from the consulate. It would have been open for certain. But any communication from the West was suspect and noted on one's record. "And the letter from Susanna," Papa said. He looked curious, but I just tucked both under my coat. I hurried home to our apartment and climbed the 3 flights of stairs, finally able to walk like a normal person. Halina had pinned a new poster on our door. "District 10 Art Exhibition. Poland in posters." It was graphic and stark. A new look for her. How had I forgotten the art show was that night? Since I'd left, Halina had attacked art with new vigor. I tried not to think about this. I set the brown paper package on the kitchen table and stared at it. I knew what was inside. I heard a pebble hit the kitchen window and went to see who'd thrown it. Neighborhood boys, no doubt. I pulled up the window sash, ready to scold, and saw Pietrik standing below. "It is a beautiful day," he said. "Come out and play." "You will break the window, those stones," I said, resting my weight on my forearms along the windowsill. He was still so handsome, like a boy. A little thicker around the middle, but everywhere we went, women still glanced at him when they thought I wasn't looking.
"Are you going to make me come up there and get you?" he said with a smile, hands on his hips.
I closed the window and he was up the stairs in seconds. He arrived in the apartment winded, his cheeks flushed. He came to me and tried to kiss me, but I turned away.
"Remember me, your husband?" he said.
"I think I have the flu. My muscles ache. I can't stop sweating."
"Still?" said Pietrik.
"Maybe because you're not taking those pills."
"I don't know," I said.
Pietrik placed his hand on the package. "What is this?" "From Caroline," I said.
"Well?"
Pietrik tossed the box to me. "Open it." I caught it. "Not yet."
"What are you waiting for, Kasia?"
"I know what's in it. She wants me to go up to a town in Germany called Stocksee, to identify."
"Who?"
I placed the box back on the table. "Hertha Oberhäuser."
"She's out?" Pietrik said.
"They think she might have a medical practice up there, and they need an eyewitness identification from someone who knows what she looks like."
"Still a doctor? Are you going?"
I said nothing.
"You'd need special papers, Kasia, and even that doesn't guarantee they let you through."
"That's what is in the package," I said.
"And it isn't cheap. The gas alone..."
"That's in there too," I said. "Knowing Caroline, both Zwatis and Marx." Pietrik took a step closer. "We have to go, Kasia. Finally, we can do something to get back at them. I'll come with you. Just getting across the border is dicey as hell. Do you know how many people have died crossing it?"
"Illegally. People do it legally every day." "It's harder now. Plus the area's full of booby traps and minefields. 50,000 GDR guards patrol it. All top marksmen. When in doubt, they shoot first."
Pietrik took up my hands in his.
"I'll come with you. Halina can stay with your parents."
"I'm done with all that, Pietrik. The underground. Ravensbrück. I need to move on."
"That's the problem. You can't move on. Have you even said two words to your daughter since you've been home?"
"She's been busy with art class. She missed you when you were gone, made the calendar, and X'd off the days till you came home."
"I'm working two shifts now," I said.
Pietrik took hold of my shoulders. "Can you make room for her? She's always over at Marta's." He walked to the chair where he'd thrown his jacket and reached for it. "It's always someone else, Kasia." Pietrik headed for the door. "You never learn, do you?"
"Where are you going?" I asked.
"To our daughter's art show." I stepped toward him. How could he just leave?
"What about dinner?" "I'll eat elsewhere."
He stopped at the doorway.
"And give serious thought to going up to Stocksee with me. It isn't every day you get a chance to do something like this, Kasia."
I turned away and heard the door close, my stomach ready to erupt. I watched him through the window as he walked off, hands in his pockets. Halina met him in the street, hauling a black portfolio pregnant with artwork. They embraced and went their separate ways. Halina headed up to the apartment. When she reached our place, I was still nursing a grudge.
"You look awful," Halina said.
"Thanks.
Are you coming to my art show tonight? I was kind of hoping you would."
Halina looked more like an artist every day. That day, dressed in one of Pietrik's old shirts, splattered with paint, she wore her blonde hair piled on top of her head, as my mother used to. It was hard to look at her, almost the exact image of Matka. I tucked Caroline's package under the table. I have work to do. You've never been to one of my shows, Matka. A teacher wants to buy my poster. I looked out the window. Better run and catch father. He'll buy you dinner. They are serving cheese at the show, Halina said.
And vodka, I suppose.
Yes.
If the modern art wasn't modern enough, it would become so after a paper cup of 200-proof alcohol. Run along and find father, I said.
Halina left without a goodbye. I went to the window and watched her when she made it to the street below. She looked so small. Would she turn and wave? No. At least Halina connected with one parent. I opened Susanna's letter, a short one and to the point, the way she always handled things when the news was bad. She would not be returning. She had extended her visa again and hinted a wedding was in the works. There was one bright note, though. The doctors at Mount Sinai agreed that her cancer was still in remission. I drank to that, draining one of my airplane vodkas. There was only hot cereal in the cupboard, so I made a bowl and poured a glass of Pietrik's vodka. For vodka made in someone's basement, it traveled down the throat easily. As Papa used to say, you could taste the potatoes. It was more flavorful than the airplane vodka, and it stayed down as long as I didn't imagine the contents of my stomach. Gray hot cereal and vodka sloshing around. No wonder Pietrik drank it on occasion. It made my whole body tingle and warmed arms and fingers, head and ears. Even my brain was numb by the time I slipped into my American dress. I smiled at the mirror. With my tooth repaired, I could look at myself again. Why shouldn't I go and enjoy my daughter's big night? The nylon stockings covered the few scars I had left. Even my husband might be happy to see me. It was a short walk to Halina's school. I stepped into the gymnasium and found it filled with bright spotlights trained on posters hung on the cinder block walls. People milled about admiring the students' artwork. Martha and Papa stood at the opposite end of the room, talking to an arty-looking couple. A card table across the room held bottles of vodka and a paper plate of cheese cubes.
You came, Matka, Halina said with a smile. First time ever. Come, let me show you everything.
Pietrik stood at the other end of the room, leaning with his hand on the wall, in deep conversation with a woman in a red hat.
Perhaps some cheese first, I said, my breath suddenly short.
We went to the refreshment table, and I took some cheese cubes and a paper cup of vodka.
Since when do you drink vodka? Halina asked.
It's important to try new things, I said.
I tasted it, then tipped my head back and drank it in one shot. It was smoother and had a more refined taste than ours at home. I was becoming a vodka aficionado.
Let me show you my self-portrait, Halina said.
She took my hand in hers, and my eyes stung with tears. When was the last time she had taken my hand? Halina's work was grouped along one wall, full of bright color, graphic and strong. A portrait of a woman, Martha no doubt, cooking, painted as if through a kaleidoscope. Next, a fish with an automobile body full of gears and machine parts.
Do you like the one in the kitchen? Halina asked.
The one of Martha? What pretty colors.
That isn't Martha. It's you, she said. I did it in blue, your favorite.
More tears came to my eyes, and the colors swirled like paint in a water jar.
Me? I said. How nice. I have been waiting to show you the best one. Teacher wants to buy it, but I may keep it. I tried to dry my eyes with my napkin as Halina brought me farther down the wall to her self-portrait. Once I stood there in front of that canvas, it was as if it reached out and bit me. It was so alive.
Well,
Halina said. It was the largest painting in the room. A woman's full face with golden hair and a wreath of thorns wrapped around her head. It was my mother. I became warm all over and my head spun. I need to sit down.
You don't like it,
Halina said. She folded her arms across her chest. Yes, yes, I do. I just need to sit. I sat on a folding chair and watched Pietrik laugh with his lady friend while Halina went to fetch me another vodka. There was a reason I didn't go out much. Halina grabbed Pietrik's hand and brought him over.
Here, Matka,
Halina said, handing me a cup of vodka.
What got you to come here? Asked Pietrik with a smile. Wild horses?
Certainly not you, I said. Pietrik's smile faded.
Not here, Kasia.
You're enjoying the show, I said, with a jerk of my chin in the red hat's direction. My vision was blurry, my tongue loosened by the spirits.
You've been drinking? Pietrik said. Only you are allowed to drink, I said, taking a sip from the paper cup.
I felt a new clarity of thought. Pietrik reached for the cup.
I'm taking you home. I snatched the cup back and stood just as Marta and Papa came by, Halina's art teacher in tow.
You are Halina's mother, said the teacher, a pretty, dark-haired woman who wore round black glasses and a violet kaftan. The teacher put one arm, the sleeve like a bat wing, over Halina's shoulder. Halina and I have long talks, said the teacher. She speaks highly of you.
Oh, really? I said. She admits she has a mother?
The group laughed a little too hard. It was not that funny.
Oh, yes. Teens, said the teacher.
Have you seen Halina's self-portrait? My colleague at the university says it's his favorite piece here.
It's my mother, I said.
Pardon? Said the teacher.
Marta and Papa exchanged looks. The room spun like a funhouse.
Halina painted it of herself, Kasia, Marta said.
Pietrik took my arm.
If you knew my mother, you wouldn't be sleeping in her bed today, I said. We're going home, said Pietrik. I pulled away from his tight fingers.
Halina may not have told you in one of those long talks, but I got my mother killed by working in the underground, after all she did for me. I brought the paper cup to my lips, and it collapsed in my hand, splashing vodka down my dress front.
Pietrik, we'll take Halina home to our house, Marta said.
Yes. My mother was an artist, just like Halina here. But she drew portraits for bad people. Nazis, in fact, if you must know. I felt my face wet with tears.
What happened to her?
Only God knows, Mrs. Art Teacher.
Because she never said goodbye. But take it from me. The woman in that poster is my mother.
All I remember after that is Pietrik holding me up on the way home, us stopping for me to be sick in an alleyway, and to wipe formerly hot cereal off my American dress. I woke before dawn the next morning.
Water,
I called out, for a second thinking I was in the Revere at Ravensbrück. I sat up in Halina's bed and saw that my dress had been exchanged for my nightshirt. Pietrik had changed me. The previous night bobbed to the surface, and my cheeks burned there in the dark. What a fool I'd made of myself. Even before rising, I knew I'd go to Stocksee. I walked past Pietrik's room. He slept with one arm across his face, chest bare. Beautiful. What if I just crawled in with him? Why didn't I have the courage to sleep with my own husband? As dawn broke outside our window, I gathered my overnight things and pulled open Caroline's package, careful not to make a sound. In the small box, I found my transit papers, German money, Polish money, a letter addressed to Germany's largest newspaper, detailing Hertha Oberhäuser's war crimes at Ravensbrück, and her early release, complete with German postage. 3 maps, a list of approved gas stations at which to purchase fuel, and detailed travel instructions. A note apologizing for only being able to obtain one set of travel papers, and a whole package of Fig Newton cookies. I tossed the box in my suitcase and clicked the locks. Pietrik stirred in the next room. I froze for a second. Should I leave a note? I scribbled a quick goodbye on the paper from Caroline's package and made my way down the stairs to the old turquoise car Papa loaned me now and then, the one Pietrik had kept alive for years. As Papa said, that car had more rust on it than paint, but it got us wherever we needed to go. At first I fretted as I drove. What if it really was Hertha? Would she hurt me? Would I hurt her? My head cleared a bit once I was underway, one of the few drivers on the road that early. I spread a map and the driving instructions out on the seat next to me, turned the radio volume up, cranked the window down, and breakfasted on a whole cellophane sleeve of Fig Newtons. The box said, "New twin pack stays fresher." And they did taste better than ever. Soft and moist cookie outside, sweet figgy middle. Eating these helped my mood very much. Perhaps this trip was a good idea after all. On my way northwest, I passed through one neglected village after another, the only color in the drab towns, the red on white propaganda posters, proclaiming the virtues of socialism and the unbreakable friendship with the peoples of the Soviet Union. The travel arrangements were complicated, since Germany had been stripped of all the land it had taken during the war. In the east, it had been returned to Poland under Russian occupation, and in the west, it was divvied up between the Western Allies. 2 new states had been created out of occupied Germany, Free West Germany, no longer fully occupied by the Allies, and the smaller German Democratic Republic, or GDR, in the east. It took me a whole day to make it through Poland and East Germany. The roads were potholed and often strewn with litter, and it was rare to see other passenger cars. A Soviet military convoy lumbered by, license plates painted out. The soldiers riding in the back of the trucks eyed me as if I were circus oddity. The first night I slept in my car, one eye open, alert for robbers. The next day, through dense fog and drizzle, I made it to the inner German border, the 1,393-kilometer boundary between West German and Soviet territories. Caroline had directed me to one of the few routes open to non-Germans, the northernmost designated transit route, to the Lübeck-Schlutup checkpoint. As I approached the guardhouse and the red-striped pole which blocked the road, I slowed and pulled up behind the last car in line. Light rain fell on the car roof as I waited, and I studied the white concrete watchtower standing along the wall in the distance. Were they watching me from up there? Could they see my dying car spewing lavender smoke as I waited? Somewhere a guard dog barked, and I considered the stark surrounding countryside and the long metal fence that ran the length of the road. Was that where the booby traps were, beyond that fence? I would be fine as long as I didn't have to get out of the car. My car inched forward in line, my naked windshield wipers useless,
the rubber stolen long before by petty bandits. I turned off my radio so I could concentrate. Where was Susanna when I needed her? Oh, yes, enjoying her new life in New York City. I rechecked my papers for the 10th time. 3 pages thick and signed in ink with a flourish. Kasia Kuzmeritsk, cultural ambassador, it said. I ran my finger over the raised seal. I certainly didn't look like any cultural ambassador, but those papers made me feel important. Safe. By the time I made it to the gate, my dress was soaked with sweat under my heavy coat. I rolled down my window to speak with the East German guard.
Polsky? Said the guard.
I nodded and handed him my papers. He took one look and turned toward the guardhouse, my papers in hand.
Don't turn off the car, he said in German.
I waited and studied my gas gauge. Was the needle actually moving downward as I watched? 2 more East German soldiers swept aside the guardhouse curtains and glanced out at me. At last, a middle-aged officer came out to my car.
Get out of the car, he said in German-accented Polish.
Why, I said, where are my papers?
They have been impounded, said the officer.
Why had I not listened to Pieterk? Maybe he was right. Some people never learn. Chapter 45, Kasia, 1959. It took me some time to get out of my car at the checkpoint, for the door would not open, no matter how I tried. I climbed across and out the passenger side, much to the amusement of the border guards, standing there flaunting their rifles. The rain was down to a fine mist, and I watched it collect and bead on the shiny cap brim of the officer who had ordered me out. I braced myself with one hand on the hood of the car, for my legs felt about to fail, then snatched it away, for the metal was hot from the engine. Was the car about to overheat?
You have fancy papers, the officer said. They have, however, been replaced with a one-day pass.
But they are...
If you don't like it, turn around, the officer said. Either way, get this car out of here. It's on its last leg.
I took the pass. Did he see my fingers trembling? The pass, soggy by then, and no bigger than a pack of cigarettes, was a miserable exchange for my beautiful papers.
Make sure you are back here by 6 tomorrow morning, or you'll be living here in this house with us.
He waved the next car forward, signaling the end of the conversation. Back in the driver's seat, I broke out in a cold sweat of relief. The second checkpoint was easier, and once the West German border guards checked me through, I crossed into the West and drove north towards Stocksee. West Germany was like a different world, a wonderland of green fields and neat farms. The road was smooth, and modern trucks passed me on that popular trucking route, for my car refused to go over 50 miles per hour. I stopped only once, at the first telegraph office I saw, and sent a wire to Caroline saying I was on my way. Somewhere on the outskirts of Stocksee, I heard a terrific clank and turned to see my muffler fall on the asphalt and clatter to the side of the road. I backed up and retrieved the lanky hunk of metal and hurled it into my back seat. After that, my car sounded like the loudest motorbike when I pressed the gas pedal. But what choice did I have? I had to keep going. I chugged into Stocksee in the early afternoon and shivered as I passed the flowered sign.
Willkommen in Stocksee!
Hertha's home base? It was a rural town close to a lake with the same name, a big lake. Tranquil and dark. She always did like lakes. I drove past rolling farmland and into the heart of Stocksee, a tidy little place. If the dress of the inhabitants was any indication, Stocksee was a conservative place too, for most wore traditional tracht, the men in lederhosen, trachtencoats, and alpine hats.
The women in dirndl dresses. I slowed my car by a sidewalk and asked the man for help in my best rusty German. Excuse me, sir. Could you tell me where Dorfstrasse can be found? The man ignored me and kept walking. A stab of fear went through me when I saw a woman resembling Gerda Querheim, Nurse Gerda from the camp, pass by on the sidewalk. Could it possibly be her? Out of prison already? I found the doctor's office, a single-story building of white-painted brick. I parked far down the street, relieved to turn my car off, and sat there attracting hostile looks from passers-by. One peered into the back seat in a pointed way, looking at the muffler lying there. I tried to steady my breathing and gain courage. Should I just return home? Call the police and ask for help? That might not end well. A silver Mercedes-Benz slid by me and docked at the curb in front of the doctor's office. It was an older model, but the kind of car Pietrik would have admired. A woman got out of the car. Could that possibly be Hertha driving such an expensive car? Why had I forgotten my glasses? My heart beat like a crazy, flip-flopping fish. The woman was too skinny to be her, wasn't she? My hands were slippery on the steering wheel as I watched the woman walk into the doctor's office. I slid to the passenger door and exited, the hinges complaining, and shook my hands about like two wet mops, trying to calm myself. I entered the doctor's office and stopped to read the brass sign next to the door. Family Medical Clinic. The words, "We love children," were painted below. Children? It couldn't be Hertha. Who would let someone like her touch their little ones? It wasn't a big waiting room, but it was unnervingly neat and tidy. The walls were painted with schools of manic fish and turtles, and an aquarium bubbled in the corner. I sat and thumbed through magazines, glancing now and then at the patients, waiting to see if she'd walk by. It was hard to look at those well-fed infants with their velvety skin, and know Hertha might be the one touching them. As their names were called, the mothers went in to see the doctor, just as we once had. Did she give them their inoculations, or leave that to a nurse? I watched an angelfish in the tank suck in and spit rocks from the pink gravel bottom. A German mother sat across the room, the picture of Aryan purity. The Nazis would have put her on the cover of every magazine during the war. I considered telling her how they killed babies at Ravensbrück, but then thought better of it. Never volunteer information. The Germans were always suspicious of that. Though it was cool in the room, sweat ran down my back. To calm myself, I paged through German Mother magazine. The war was long since over, but the Hausfrauen had not come far. Still working hard, but no longer for their beloved Führer. If a magazine was any indication, the Germans worshipped a new idol, consumer goods, Volkswagens, hi-fis, dishwashers, and televisions. At least that was an improvement. The receptionist scraped her glass window open. "Do you have an appointment?" she asked, blue eyeshadow on her lids. "Makeup?" The Führer would not have approved. I stood. "No, but if the doctor is free, I'd like one." She handed me a clipboard, a long form trapped under the silver clamp. "Fill this out and I'll check," she said. The Germans still love their paperwork. I filled in the form with my real married name and the false address in the nearby town of Plön. It was barely readable. My fingers shook so. Why worry? The war was long over. Hitler was dead. What could Hertha do to me? I listened to the music as I waited. Tchaikovsky? It wasn't calming me. The last patient went in to see the doctor, and I sat alone. Would she remember me?
I was certain she'd recognize her own handiwork. The receptionist appeared at her window.
The doctor will see you after the last patient. I will be leaving soon, so may I have your paperwork?
Of course, I said, and handed her the clipboard. I'd be there alone with the doctor. Should I just leave?
I went to the wooden coat tree in the corner, empty except for a white lab jacket, to hang up my coat. The nameplate pinned to the breast pocket said, Dr. Oberhäuser. A chill ran through me. How strange to see that name in print. At Ravensbrück, the staff had been careful not to reveal their names. Not that we hadn't known them. The receptionist stood and tidied her desk, ready to go home.
Why stay? If I left then, no one would know I'd been here. Caroline could send someone else.
The last mother walked through the waiting room, baby at her shoulder, and smiled at me as she left the office. I thought of Mrs. Mikelski's baby with a pang of sadness. I could follow that nice girl out of the waiting room and go home to Lublin. I hurried my coat on and started toward the door, open-mouthed, sucking in air. I made it and felt the knob smooth in my hand. Just go. Before I could turn it, the receptionist opened the door that led to the back rooms.
Tasha Bakowski, she said with a smile, the doctor will see you now.
Chapter 46, Caroline, 1959. October 25th, 1959, turned out to be a perfectly lovely day for a wedding. Mother was in rare form, despite the fact the United States had just launched monkeys Abel and Baker into space on a Jupiter missile, and she was knee-deep in a letter-writing campaign to end such animal cruelty. It was a year of firsts. The first diplomatic visit to the United States by a Soviet premier, Nikita Khrushchev. The first time the musical Gypsy played on Broadway. The first wedding at the Hay. Sergei and Zuzanna were guaranteed good weather for their nuptials, since we'd erected a tent at great expense in the lower yard below the garden. It was Indian summer up in Bethlehem. Hazy, hot, and just a bit blustery. This was not a society wedding, if that is what you are accustomed to. Far from it, as our procession back from the church proved. Our raucous little group meandered from Bethlehem's Catholic church, past the town green to the Hay, attended by a great gonging of bells from the town's churches. All of Bethlehem had come out for Sergei and Zuzanna's big day, except for Earl Johnson, who felt duty-bound to remain on his post office stool. Mother, understated in gray taffeta, led the procession, Mr. Merrill from the general store by her side. She walked backward, conducting her Russian orchestra friends, their instruments festooned with gay flowers and ribbons. They performed a rousing version of Bach's Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, lovely, actually, on balalaika. Next came the bride and groom. Sergei was striking in one of Father's gabardine suits we'd cut down for him, and wore the kind of wide grin usually found on a man standing next to a trophy marlin on a Key West pier. What man wouldn't be proud to marry lovely Zuzanna? She was part Audrey Hepburn and part Grace Kelly, with the temperament of a spring lamb. She and her strong-willed sister, Kasia, were as different as chalk and cheese. Kasia, refreshingly forthright. Zuzanna, subtler. Mother had sewn Zuzanna a dress of écru lace. It was becoming, even with dollar bills pinned all about it in the Polish tradition, the breeze sending them fluttering like a flapper's fringe. The bride carried a spray of Mr. Gardiner's Souvenir de la Malmaison roses, fragrant and blush pink. The groom carried a blossom as well, a 10-month-old named Julian, P. peach-cheeked with a head full of hair that was, as Mother would say, black and straight as a Chinaman's. The dear boy had officially been theirs for 2 weeks, and his feet had yet to touch terra firma, so many adults loved holding him so. After various and sundry cousins and acquaintances came Betty and me. She was resplendent in a Chanel suit, the mink heads on her stole bouncing with each step. I wore a lavender raw silk sheath Mother had whipped up, which Susanna said suited the mother of the bride, which sent me into tears even before the service. Bringing up the rear was Lady Chatterley the sow, daisy chain around her neck, and like many of our guests, most concerned with the prospect of good cake. Our procession wended its way to our gravel driveway. Back beyond the house, behind the barns, the hayfield stretched all the way to the next street over, Munger Lane. The hay had been harvested, leaving the naked meadow spiky with tufts of straw, and the maples and elms at the meadow's edge, already starting their crimson turn, swayed in the breeze. Back there, one's eye naturally goes to the end of the meadow, beyond the orchard to my old playhouse. I considered the little house, a white clabbered echo of its parent, with its sturdy chimney and pedimented entryway fitted with child-sized benches. The black door shone in the sun, and the silk curtains Susanna had sewn, the color of pussy willows, lapped out the windows with the breeze. I was not surprised it had become Susanna's cocoon of sorts, where she went when the world was just too much. It was once my place of solace, where I'd spent days reading after Father died. Once the procession wound around to the back garden, Betty and I went to the kitchen to fetch the pedophores Sergei's sous chef had prepared. Sergei had opened a restaurant in nearby Woodbury, weekend home of well-heeled Manhattanites. He called it Sergei, and it was an immaculate hole in the wall that had a line out the door on Saturday nights. This was not surprising, since everyone knows New Yorkers, when deprived of good French food for more than 24 hours, become impossible and seek it out like truffle pigs. Or maybe it was Susanna's Polish desserts that kept patrons lining up. I do love the Polish traditions. Don't you, Caroline? Pinning money to the bride? Genius! Betty plucked a pedophore from the box and popped it into her mouth whole. I tied on one of Sergei's new aprons with his logo, the black S, down the front. Stop pinning $100 bills on the bride, Betty. It's vulgar. It's such a practical tradition. At least it's distracting Susanna from dwelling on the fact that none of her family could be here. Those two need a honeymoon, Caroline. Must be exhausting tending to a teething child. She misses her sister. Kasha, fly her in, for heaven's sake. It isn't that easy, Betty. Poland's a communist country. I had a hard enough time getting her a transit visa to go to Germany. To confront that doctor? Really, Caroline? I sent everything she needs, but I haven't heard a word from her. I'd mailed the package to Poland weeks before, express, with more than enough money for her trip to Stocksee, and still hadn't heard a peep. And I wasn't the only one waiting to hear if it truly was Hertha Oberhäuser. A slew of British doctors was ready to help me pressure the German government to revoke Hertha's medical license. Anise and friends were ready to go to battle as well. Hertha was just one of many on our list of Nazi war criminals who needed to be held accountable. Your persuasive powers are first rate, dear. You won't catch me traipsing up to some godforsaken German town to identify a deranged Nazi doctor. How did Betty manage to boil every situation down to the absurd? Had I taken advantage of Kasha by asking her to identify Hertha? She would be fine. such a strong, capable person. Not unlike myself at her age. Well, anyway, don't worry about all that, Caroline. I have a gift for you. That isn't necessary. Betty heaved a Schiaparelli toad onto the kitchen table. It's lovely, Betty. Oh, the bag is Mother's, and she wants it back. She's become positively miserly in her old age. But the gift is inside. I reached into the bag and felt the flannel. That unmistakable feeling of metal muffled by cloth, and knew instantly what it was.
Oh, Betty.
I held on to the table to steady myself. I pulled out one flannel roll and unfurled it to find a row of oyster forks. It's all there, Betty said. I've been buying it from Mr. Snyder for years. You know he calls me first when he has anything good. When he had Woolsey Silver... I pulled all 20 rolls from the bag and piled them into a brown flannel pyramid on the table. Even the silver pedophore tongs were there. Betty wrapped her arms around me, and I rested my cheek against cool, smooth mink. Now, don't get all teary on me, Caroline. This is a joyous day. How lucky I was to have such a generous friend. Mother might pretend not to care, but she would be delighted the Woolsey Silver was back. Betty and I set up the wedding cake on a card table in the garden and used my long-lost silver tongs to serve the pedophores. The happy couple stood, surrounded by wedding guests and the last of the fall smooth-leaf hydrangeas, with their white blossom globes, like bystanders craning their necks to see the festivities. Mother, holding Julian, managed to cut the cake, while the couple took her loving cup between them, sipping vodka from it, while Betty and members of the orchestra shouted, "Gorku, Gorku," bitter, bitter, to urge them to drink. On my way back to the house for more lemonade, I heard the tinkle of a bicycle bell and turned to find Earl Johnson riding around the corner of the house, his tires leaving a dark snake of an impression across the grass. He rode his red Schwinn Hornet bike, complete with chrome headlamp, the white straw basket peppered with yellow plastic daisies. Earl removed his cap and had the good sense to look sheepish.
"Sorry to ride on the grass, Miss Faraday."
"Don't worry about it, Earl," I said. "So what if I'd asked him ad nauseam not to ride on the lawn? It's only grass. Just maybe walk around next time." Susanna spotted and walked toward us, baby on her hip. On her way, she plucked a sprig of late fall lilac. She brushed it under Julian's chin, causing him to draw his legs up and down like a frog in delight. How sure Susanna's step was now that she was finally well. Earl stood straddling his bike.
"I got a letter for you. From..."
He squinted at the return address. I plucked the letter from his fingers. "Thank you, Earl." I glanced at it just long enough to see Paul's handwriting, and tucked it in my apron pocket. I ran my fingers across the letter there and felt it was thick. A good sign. Was it simply a coincidence that Pan Am had recently started direct flights from New York to Paris? Earl produced a second envelope from his bike basket.
"And a telegram, all the way from West Germany."
He handed it to me and waited, hands on his handlebar grips. "Thank you, Earl. I can take it from here." Earl turned with a "good day" and walked his bicycle back toward the front of the house, but was intercepted by Mother, who led him to the cake. Susanna reached me, an expectant look in her eyes. I tore off one side of the envelope and pulled out the telegram. "It's from Kasia, from West Germany," I caught the scent of zinc oxide and baby powder as Susanna covered my hand with hers. Cold, but caring and soft. A mother's hand. "Shall I read it aloud?" I asked. Susanna nodded. It reads, "Underway to Stocksee. Just me."
"That's it?" Susanna asked. "There must be more."
"I'm sorry, but that's all, dear." She signs off, "Kasha." Susanna released my hand and steadied herself.
"So she's going. To see if it's Hertha. By herself."
"I'm afraid so, dear. You know how important this is. She's a brave girl. She'll be fine." Susanna held Julian close.
"You don't know what they're like."
She turned and walked in the direction of the playhouse, the baby at her shoulder watching my shrinking form with one shiny fist to his mouth. The band struck up Young Love by Sonny James as I watched Susanna walk across the meadow. Once at the playhouse, she stepped inside and gently closed the door, leaving me with a sinking feeling I'd finally gone too far.
Chapter 47. Kasha. 1959. The receptionist led me into the doctor's office.
"Wait here," she said. It was nicely furnished with an oriental carpet, pale green walls, and French doors that overlooked a quiet garden. It smelled of leather and old wood, and the furniture looked expensive. An upholstered sofa. A shiny brown side table with feet like lion's paws. A tall leather chair at the doctor's wide desk. Across from the desk sat a black painted chair with a caned seat, clearly earmarked for the visitor. Could this really be where Hertha spent her days? If so, it was quite a step up from her last office. She was certainly not eating beans out of a can.
"You are the last appointment," said the receptionist. "The doctor's had a long day. 2 surgeries this morning."
"Some things never change," I said.
"Pardon me?"
I walked to the chair. "Oh, nothing." My hands shook as I grasped the wooden arms of the chair and lowered myself down. Built-in bookcases lined one wall, and the pink china clock sat on the shelf.
"I'll be leaving now," the receptionist said. "Here is your receipt. The doctor will be in shortly."
"Thank you," I said. I glanced at the receipt. "Dr. Hertha Oberhäuser," was printed in pretty script across the top. My evidence. I almost took the receptionist's hand and begged her to stay in the room with me, but instead watched her leave. What could possibly happen? She closed the door gently behind her. If this was indeed Hertha's office, how good it would feel to tell her off, then slammed that door behind me when I left. I stood and walked to the bookcase, the carpet muffling my steps. I ran one finger down a smooth, leather-bound book set and pulled out a heavy volume, Atlas of General Surgery, Hertha's specialty. I slipped the book back into place and stepped to the gilt-framed oil paintings on the wall of cows in a field. The desk held a blotter, a telephone, a facial tissue box, and a silver water pitcher on a china plate. The pitcher perspired. That made 2 of us. I looked at the diplomas framed on the wall. Düsseldorf Academy for Practical Medicine, Dermatology. There was another for infectious diseases. No surgical diploma? I poured myself a glass of water. The door opened,
and I turned to see the woman who'd stepped out of the silver Mercedes slip into the room. I froze, my mouth suddenly full of sand, and then placed my glass on the desk. It was Herta. She strode to the desk, clipboard in hand, wearing her white doctor's coat, a black stethoscope draped around her neck. Thank goodness she didn't offer to shake my hand, because my palms were wet. I sat, my whole body jellying, as she eyed my paperwork on the clipboard, her attitude somewhere between bored and irritated.
"What can I do for you today, Mrs. Bakowski? New patient?"
"New patient, yes," I said, clasping my hands in my lap to stop them from shaking. "Looking for a family doctor." She sat in the leather chair and pulled herself to the desk.
"Polish?"
she asked as she uncapped her fountain pen. Was that a hint of disdain? "Yes," I said and forced a smile. "My husband is a grocer." Why was I shaking so? What was the worst that could happen? Commandant Zuren was in a pine box in a German cemetery. Or was he? The way Nazis were turning up in that town, I might see Zuren doing the backstroke in the lake.
"You live in Plön?"
She frowned, lifted my glass from the desk, and placed a linen coaster under it. "Yes," I said.
"On School Street?"
"That's right."
"Funny. There's no School Street in Plön."
"Did I write School Street? We are new to town." Outside the window, a magpie fluttered its wings.
"What can I help you with today, Mrs. Bakowski?"
How could she not recognize me when her face was so etched in my mind? "Can you tell me your background?" I asked.
"I was trained as a dermatologist and have recently made the switch to family medicine after practicing for many years both at Hohenleichen Sanatorium and a large teaching hospital in Berlin."
Once my heart stopped thumping so loudly, I became more comfortable with my role. She really didn't recognize me.
"Oh, that must have been interesting," I said. "And before that?" "I was a camp doctor at a woman's re-education camp in Fürstenberg."
She leaned back in her chair, fingers steepled. There was no doubt it was her. But Herta had changed. She had become more refined, with her longer hair and expensive clothes. Prison had not broken her, but had made her more sophisticated somehow. My whole body tensed at the thought. How was it that the criminal was enjoying such a luxurious lifestyle while the victim was driving around in a tin can?
"Oh, Fürstenberg is lovely," I said. "The lake and all. Pretty." "So, you've been there?"
That was the moment. I had a choice. To walk out having identified her, or stay for what I really wanted. Yes, I was a prisoner there. The clock chimed the half hour.
"That was a long time ago," Herta said. She sat up straight in her chair and organized phantom objects on her desk. "If you have no further questions, I have patients to see, and I am behind schedule."
There was the old Herta. She could only be pleasant for so long. "I am your last appointment," I said. Herta smiled, a first.
"Why stir up old dust? You're here for some sort of vigilante justice?"
All my rehearsed speeches went away. "You really don't recognize me, do you?" Her smile faded. "You operated on me, killed young girls, babies. How could you do it?"
"I did my job. I spent years in prison just for doing academic research."
5 years. You were sentenced to 20. So this is your excuse, academic research?
"Research to save German soldiers. And for your information, The German government for years has exercised the right to use executed criminals for such research purposes.
Only we weren't dead, Hertha.